Oh, so am I. What can I tell you?
You've been working on your dancing, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I've been rehearsing it. Glad you noticed that.
Yeah, it doesn't leave much time for your music. You should spend more time on it because the youth of America depends on you to show the way.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Monkeys is the craziest people.
Welcome to the Last Victor Show podcast, episode 44. Coming up to the 50th episode very soon. Six episodes, in fact. My name's Simon De Berardino.
With him is Adam Robertson.
And you just heard a clip from the film that we both haven't seen.
No.
The film Head, released in 1968, I'm pretty sure. It's the Monkees movie. And that was a clip there with Frank Zappa and that Donnie guy.
Awesome. Denenz, Ricky Denenz.
Yeah, whatever. That guy.
Donnie guy.
I was thinking of The Room.
Don Johnson.
Donnie's not even in The Room.
No, it's Denny.
Denny. Jesus yeah. Christ.
Started well.
It's the preface show part two here because I am batshit stupidly insane out of my mind tired.
Yeah.
And you've had a day off,
no
so you got nothing. Welcome to the show this week. For you, we have a couple of things. We have
three, as
per usual.
Yeah.
We have a new album from the Japanese extreme metal band Psy called Insomnophobia, which we're going to be talking about first. After that, we're going to be having a bit of a chat about the new Norwegian thriller Headhunters. And finally, we're going to head into episode 3 of our demo tape segment, which we're looking at proto and classic punk with New York Dolls' self-titled album of 1973. But before we do any of that, what have you been doing this week, Adam J. Robertson?
Your voice went a bit funny there. I haven't been doing a whole lot, to be honest, besides the film that we watched. I haven't watched anything, but I was meant to be watching...
Shocking.
I was meant to be watching The Walking Dead Season 1, but it still hasn't come in yet, and it's out tomorrow, so I'm kind of disappointed about that. I was really keyed up to watch it, but I've been listening to heaps of stuff. I had a bit of a listen to that Big Creed album, which you gave me. Kind of digging it. I really want to give it tons more listens. But I listened to Buzzcocks' singles Going Steady, which was one of the albums we were considering doing for our punk thing, but we didn't get around to it. But it's a great album, like really edgy but quite fun, like kind of quite different to the Sex Pistols, which is, you know, just so aggressive.
Yeah.
Revisited an old classic, The Soft Bulletin by The Flaming Lips. It's so good. It's I think it might be a 5-star album, actually.
It's my favorite Flips album, I think.
It is by far for me. I mean, I love Yoshimi and Embryonic's not bad. And
Embryonic's great.
Yeah.
I really like it.
Yeah, like, and I haven't got around to Zurika or Clouds. What was it? Cloud Taste Metallic?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah. So, look, I've got to get those a listen. And it's kind of just revisiting a lot of punk albums that around the time, and I listened to Combat Rock by The Clash. It's a bit of a turd.
Yeah. I've heard.
Yeah, it's...
Lewis Carroll just walked in the room.
There's a couple of good tracks on there. That's about it. And I finally finished reading Watchmen. It took me forever. But I literally just read half of it last night, and I was up to like 3 a.m. It was great. It was so good. So I'm going to have to, track down some more Alan Moore stuff.
Mm.
Yeah.
Creep of Vendetta is really good too.
Yeah, I'll give that a go, I think.
Do it.
Yeah. What about you?
Yeah, pretty much the same. Can't believe you forgot that we watched Troll 2.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I mean, I know we've done it about seven times already.
I knew if I forgot it, you wouldn't. So
we entered some new inductees into the Troll 2 Hall of Fame. I watched a Hitchcock film called Marnie.
Yeah, I saw that on your
Late
Twitter
Hitchcock
feed.
Film, yeah. So it's pretty good.
Yeah.
It's good and stuff. It was more for a school thing, so like
doesn't matter. It's a good
excuse. It was really interesting to analyze, but I don't know if I dug it that much as a film. I watched Sun Solil, the Chris Marker film, Sunless, which is a masterpiece, absolute masterpiece. I've been listening to the new album by The Men, Open Your Heart.
I've got it.
It's
haven't listened
really
to it
great.
Yet.
It's this really kind of, unabashed embracing of just rock music and great guitar music, and it's just varies in the kind of tones and styles of guitar anthems and rocks that it has, but it's just really fun, really.
Yeah, I've got to give it a go.
Time album.
I've got it.
Yeah, do it, man.
I'm sure Brad will be happy that I've got a mention.
And I know you will like this one. I started reading Cat's Cradle.
Oh, Vonnegut.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it's really good
and
so
it's
far.
It's quite funny as well. Especially the missionary character.
Yeah, well, I've only in like 9 chapters in, which is like, you know, there's like 200 of them or something.
Yeah, it's kind of something.
Yeah, but I started reading... God damn it. Unto Sickness and Death. I can't remember.
What, the Kiss Guard?
Oh, that's it. Yeah. I'm trying to turn around so I can see it.
I was wondering what you were doing.
And I was just not in the right frame of mind, obviously. Yeah. A very similar frame of mind that I was in right now and could not retain anything. So I put that down. I started reading Cat's Cradle, and I'm very happy that I did.
Yeah.
That's about it, really.
No, he's good. He's a good writer, Vonnegut. Breakfast of Champions is brilliant.
Yeah, you have championed that book many a time.
I have mentioned it a few times, so you can borrow that off me when you're done.
Oh, After the Stranger.
Yeah, which I can't find anywhere.
You just let yourself out on air there, man. Let yourself out.
Let yourself out on air. What does that even mean? Look, just
it was
cut
supposed
the track.
It was supposed to be exposed yourself, you know. But
and that didn't sound too good, did
it? It's not great. Let's go to what are we going to do? Sigh.
Yeah, that's it.
Insomnophobia. And that was Outkast with the song Gasoline Dreams off Stankonia, released in the year 2000. Gasoline Dreams, Insomnophobia, Sigh, album we're about to talk about right now. Huh? Tell me about it.
The most tenuous link I've ever heard.
Japanese metal band Sigh originally began as a black metal band. They were signed by Euronymous of Mayhem and released their first album on his label, but since their inception have shifted their style into a more progressive and experimental act while still retaining their extreme edge. With their latest Insomnophobia, the band have continued in this vein, with this being the second album to feature saxophonist Dr. McCannibal. Who features quite heavily on this release. It's a woman as well, I'm pretty sure, I think. The album seems to be a themed experience, or attempts to be, with the centre of the record being tagged Lucid Nightmares, and it's bookended by two tracks on either side. So the two tracks at the beginning and the two tracks at the end, and then everything in the middle is called Lucid Nightmares. Insomnophobia was released on the 12th of March via Candlelight Records, and I'm about to ask you a question about it. Are you ready? It's a simple question. It's a very simple question. Is this a case of style over substance? And if so, is substance really a prerequisite for enjoyment? Do we need the substance if it's not there?
It's a very open-ended question you've got there.
Yeah, well, you can do the first bit first. Like, is this style over substance? Do you think?
Look, I think there's a bit of style about this album, but substance-wise, I think it's got quite a bit. I think there's a lot to enjoy about this album. Like, there's a few problems, and we'll get into that. But overall, I think it was a very enjoyable listening experience for me. I felt that its strength was also its weakness as well. It covered a lot of genres in here.
Yeah.
And obviously, it was at its strongest when it blended them well. Sometimes they didn't meld quite well. But, you know, that's the risk you take, I guess, when you're trying to throw in all these genres. But style over substance, I think.
As in, like, did you notice design? Yeah, you know, like, did you notice them making songs and styling songs and like picking genres and piecing them together, that sort of thing, like this preconceived notion of style rather than writing songs that come from somewhere.
Yeah, I think I did notice it a couple of times, particularly on the track Amnesia, which, you know, was one of my favourite tracks off the album. I think they were sort of picking, you know, two or three and trying to blend them together to see where it went. But I think they were doing it in a way not for sort of, you know, for the sake of melding, but more to get an interesting sort of variation. Like, I mean, Amnesia's got sort of death metal and, you know, traditional lounge jazz.
Yeah.
And it worked, you know, like it works really well. So, yeah, look, I think on this album, there is a bit of that going on, but it worked. But I think on an enjoyment side, I'd prefer substance over style, obviously.
Yeah.
Everyone does, I suppose, to some degree. But, I mean, there's obviously enjoyable albums that, you know, don't hold your listening for, you know, more than a few months because it's just style and it's just instrumentalship over, you know, substance.
It's the classic Dream Theater argument, right? So Dream Theater were a band that started out playing this quite complex and interesting brand of progressive metal, but at the same time were writing music that seemed to emote, seemed to have some sort of grounding in some human experience and human emotion, right? And they melded those quite well, and then they stray away from that and you begin to see all it is design, and all it is like that sort of even the emotional and the cathartic parts of the music are designed as well, and you start to see like a proper structure to it, in which it becomes all style. Yeah,
yeah, virtuosity.
Which I kind of got with this more than there is any real kind of connect. Like, it's hard to talk about without sounding like a wanker. Like, really, like to some sort of like human connection, or, you know, like almost like the music itself is a bridge between the artist and the listener. Yeah, like that sort of thing. I didn't get very much of that here. That being said, my point is that I don't really need it sometimes.
No, I don't think you do. Yeah.
And there is some in here. And like Amnesia, I agree with you, but at the end of that track, there's this really great guitar solo in there, and then this really great piano interlude that comes after that. And that kind of, you know, I felt like there was some sort of connection between the person playing the guitar and me at that point, and the playing the piano. And so there's enough in here for me to kind of overlook the fact that this is very heavily sculpted and very heavily designed, but in quite an enjoyable way, I think.
Yeah, and that being said, you know, I didn't think the production was the greatest.
Really?
Yeah, I thought it was a bit muddy.
I didn't really notice it, I don't think. But
yeah, like, I didn't really notice it until someone sort of raised the point, like, it, you know, is the production as good as it could be? And I think on this sort of styling of avant-gardism, it probably would serve to be quite crisp. But then again, you get this sort of, as you said, the Lucid Nightmare thing. That's quite interesting because each song in that bridge in between the two bookends is very chaotic and spasmodic and very uncomfortable. You know, you get these really sort of evil carnival feel.
Yeah.
And to me, it sounded like, because I was playing Mega Man X not long ago, like it was like a really quite evil version of a Mega Man song, like in terms of that Japanese feel to it, and something was not quite what it seemed. But yeah, look, I really dug this album. I think it's the strongest I've heard by them. I mean, I didn't really give Imaginary Soundscapes.
I think Sonic, it sounds yeah, Sonic.
I didn't give, yeah, Sonic Say. I didn't give that much of a listen. That's the only other album I've heard by them. Mm. So, look, I liked it.
Yeah, no, so did I. I did like it. And I have a problem as well, kind of, with the avant-garde tag a little bit. Because, like, avant-garde to me is not this kind of music.
No, I think of John Zorn.
Yeah, I think of that. I think of, like, I don't know, John Cale.
Zappa.
Like, I just think of, like, music concrete, like stuff that's
that bridges
that line or walks that fine line between music and noise. Yeah, and I don't think this does it. This is pretty structured music. Like this is musicality in here.
Yeah, there's not much experimenting within.
No, the I mean tracks. They're getting different genres, and it is definitely odd, and it is very weird, the music. But I think people just equate nowadays like weirdness. That means it's avant-garde, but avant-garde really is kind of like supposed to be like a mirror image to a traditional musical sort of structuring.
It's meant to be as far away from that
and
as possible.
Yeah, it's like ignore the boundaries that music holds and just run wild and run rampant with it. It was a tongue twister from the beginning.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I just don't, the avant-garde thing doesn't really sit that well with me. Something I noticed that this is quite removed from their earlier work. Like their earlier stuff's pretty straight black metal, and they start to move after, I think, Imaginary Sonicscape. They start to move into a more progressive and experimental side of things. But what I really like about it is that it grounds itself still in that black metal and sort of rock bass, So, like, most of the songs have dueling guitars. Most of the songs have, like, fast drums and rasped vocals and stuff. Like, they keep those things. They have the orchestral keyboards that are traditional to black metal, sort of. And they keep those things, but then they give themselves enough room to be able to deviate from that quite a bit, which is great. And like, it doesn't make it seem so random and chaotic and spastic. It's just kind of like a black metal album that's gone a bit colourful and gone a bit crazy. And you take a song like the Transfiguration Fear, which is the second track. That thing opens with bongos, has choirs, has hand claps in it, whistling, saxophone solos, and heavy orchestral keyboards. But it works because it's got that rock anchorage to it, that black metal anchor. And the same with, like, you know, most of the songs, like, there's some Middle Eastern stuff in there, some French accordion.
Yeah, real. I even got a bit of Latin jazz in that song as well.
But it's like it doesn't feel unnatural to the song, which I quite like, because each of the songs retains that black metal sort of pulling point, which is something I really liked about the album and made it much more enjoyable rather than just a whole bunch of crazy things happening.
Yeah, like, it was rooted within its black metal sensibilities. I mean, you get a lot of real Emperor-esque moments, particularly with the guitars. There was one track, which I can't quite remember, but it had a very Yian Transporium sort of...
Nothing's bad about that.
Yeah, feel to it in terms of the guitars building up. And, look, I got real good black metal sense. But for me, it was the jazz sections. They were really sort of Eiffel Duath sort of styling.
Even some, like, film score stuff, like Ennio Morricone and Angelo Badalamenti, like, who does Lynch's stuff. Like, you do get some of that on there as well.
And again, they threw in, like, this weird carnival-esque feel to it as well. Like, really, and for me, that's quite not uncomfortable enough to not listen, but it's...
You've got to think about clowns, don't you?
A little, yeah. I don't really like them, but just that sort of, you know, chaotic, but trying to suggest a form of weird happiness to it. I can't really say much more about it than it was a really varied listen, and you don't really notice, I think, the length.
No, that's another thing too. I'm with you there.
It is quite long.
It's really long. Like, it's over an hour long.
Yeah.
But yeah, it kind of goes past quite breezily because it's so interesting. And it kind of, you know, like, you talk about the carnivalesque thing. I also got like a camp horror feel.
Okay,
classic sci-fi. Yeah. That's where the film score thing comes from a little bit. And it's got that Bungle, Secret Chiefs 3.
Yeah.
It's kind of from that school of things. And that's something I always really respected about Mr. Bungle's California, right, is it totally deviates constantly. Every song is different on that album, but it all sounds like Mr. Bungle, which is something that the Psy have managed to accomplish here as well. Like, it all sounds like Psy, but it is quite tangential and goes off all the time. So that was something I really dug. And you know what else I just really, like, on a base kind of level, on like a personal level, like a non-critical level, I just this is just kind of like what I love about metal. This album.
Yeah.
Kind of typifies some of the things that I really dig about it, like its willingness to experiment. Mm. It's sort of willingness to poke fun at itself. It's tongue-in-cheek nature. Like, not everybody that sings about Satan and that sings about hell actually believes in it and wants to, you know, proclaim these messages. And, like, virtuosity and musicianship, I just really, like, and craftsmanship within the songs, it's kind of got all the things that I really like about metal in there. So, you know, I really like this album too.
Yeah, it also had sort of a deconstruction, as in the Devin Townsend album vibe about it as well. Like, again, length wasn't a problem. No. It did enough different to keep you interested for that entire journey. And for that, from a metal band, from an album that is that long is, yeah, is an effort, and I've done very well.
It's quite memorable too. Like, a lot of the songs actually are, yeah, like you oftentimes when we do this podcast and I listen to albums, like I'll listen to it and I'll be in my fourth listen of something, I'll be like, this feels like the first time I've listened to it. Like, nothing's really catching
me.
Yeah,
I know what you mean.
After like the second time here, I was kind of like, oh, wow, I remember all of this.
Yeah.
This is great. What about things you didn't like?
Yeah, for me, it was the production, really. Mm. That was the biggest, I guess, draw for me. And again, some of the genres didn't meld so well. Mm-hmm. In the case that they weren't, you know, they weren't not enjoyable. They were, you know, kind of noticeable that they were switching.
Yeah, it kind of takes you out of it a little bit.
Yeah, that's all the criticism I really got. Like, I mean, maybe that the good moments weren't amazing.
Yeah.
But they were solid.
Yep.
And consistent. And, you know, that's, look, a very minor.
Yeah, I got a couple that
would
just annoy me. And most of it happens in that Lucid Nightmares thing. I know it's meant to be tongue-in-cheek, but those... It only happens a couple of times too, but the fantasy weird voiceovers, explaining the story or whatever,
yeah,
kind of dumb. Like, it sounded to me like Christopher Lee impersonating Smeagol
from Rhapsody.
Yeah, it's just bad. I never liked the fake synth sound.
Yeah,
you know, the fake orchestral. Okay,
yeah.
I never dug that, and here it doesn't sit quite well. Emperor, you funnily enough, use it actually really well.
I think they're one of the only bands.
Yeah,
to do
one
it.
Of very few. And Immortal.
Yeah.
I love Immortal.
Yeah.
There's that track, Amongst the Phantoms of Abandoned Tumbrils. Yeah. That has the most evident use of the stupid fake synth orchestral thing. The interludes as well. Like, after every song, there's like a minute of weird noises.
Yeah.
But I didn't, like, it just broke the flow for me a little bit. I was kind of like, they just got lost in a Foley room somewhere and we're just like, let's just put some stuff together. I don't know. It's just like...
It's the gap in between the stages of sleep.
Oh, wow. Totally has changed my whole review right now.
Just made that up.
And what else? I liked that the whole length of the album wasn't bored once. The last track, though, is kind of unnecessary. Somewhat. Maybe only because Fall to the Thrall... The album the song comes before it is so big and has these great sort of dramatic guitars at the end of it. And
yeah, that's the one that had that Emperor sort of moment.
Yeah, I really would have liked it to finish on that. But
yeah, I'd agree with you on that, actually. I think it's a good point, yeah.
But other than that, it's a solid, fun, progressive album, metal album. And, you know, I look forward to seeing what happens now. Because apparently this is, like, they've been going in this direction, but this is like a full... embrace of this kind of path that they've deviated.
Well, I guess this is sort of the treading the water, and the next album hopefully will be their biggest hit, I guess.
Magnum opus.
Yes.
Perhaps.
Perhaps.
I also like it's called Insomnophobia, and it kind of almost operates on a weird dream, somnambulist kind of level as well. It's not explicit, but it's there. I liked it. I'm going to give it 4 out of 5.
Yeah. I'm going to give it the same.
Solid.
Yeah.
Four out of five. Yeah, it's the best thing I've heard this year, I think. Oh, second best.
Yeah, it'd be second best for me, but not by much.
Yeah.
Yeah, but no, definitely recommend it.
Most def. It is out now, but I don't know where you can get it. Specialty shops and online once again.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, listeners, Australia is not the best place to buy CDs and DVDs.
No, specifically metal.
Yeah, but we're going to cut to a track. I picked the track Amnesia. I really liked it. Yeah, that lounge jazz thing going on. But then the end has this great guitar solo, which I think I'll play that bit there. We'll be back after this to have a bit of a chat about Headhunters.
Let's start at the beginning. This is Roger Brown, corporate headhunter. Addicted to luxury. Buried in debt. and hiding a secret life. And this is the man.
Please, can you?
With a deadly past.
Who is this? Who film?
Så man råder det här till röksig på film.
And a priceless secret.
Klas Greve har ett äkte rubis på.
Hur mycket tror du det är värt?
Kanske 100.
Du är kandidat.
Det är de här mikroskopiska scenerna. Roger! Det fäster sig på allt.
Så du vad som skedde? Var det någon där?
Well, that was the trailer to Headhunters. Before that, you heard Amnesia by the Japanese band Psy, taken from their album. That was bad. From their album In Somnophobia. Well, now it's time for Headhunters. Can't swear.
Hello.
Now we have to tick that explicit sign.
I always do.
Yeah. Do you? Anyway, just in case.
Yeah. Sorry, I've interrupted everything today.
That's all right. That's fine. We'll just ignore it happened. All right. Headhunters is the Norwegian film released in 50 countries before it even premiered in Norway, oddly enough.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Norway was one of the last. In 2011. It was directed by Morten Tildum and stars Askell Henny as Roger Brown, Sinuv McCurdy Lund as his wife Diana Brown, and Nicolaj Costa Valdu as Klaas Grieve. The film regards the exploits of Roger Brown. Wait, start. Let's go back to the beginning.
Oh, it's shocking, wasn't it?
The worst trailer I've ever heard. Who is an accomplished headhunter who risks everything to obtain a valuable painting owned by a former mercenary. So, Simon, my question to you is, we're seeing a slew of foreign films getting remade, and the word is that Mark Wahlberg was stunned by this film and is interested in remaking it, putting himself in the lead role as Roger Brown.
It's not narcissistic.
Yeah, so I've got a loaded question, a two-parter. What is the obsession with Hollywood remakes as of late, and do you think this is actually worthy of one to begin with?
Okay. I don't know what the obsession with Hollywood remakes is. Hollywood's always remade things.
Go back to the 50s and 60s.
Even earlier, man. Go back to the 10s and 20s. Hollywood, we're remaking stuff like Scarface.
The original one.
The original one. But, I meant to say the Maltese Falcon, the famous one we know, is actually the third, incarnation of Maltese Falcon.
Yeah.
So they've been remaking stuff for ages. And recently it's been sort of an import from international markets, international films, and remaking them within a number of years. I just think that Hollywood just likes ideas. Yeah, and now that we have such a global market for films, it's much easier to access these films immediately, whereas in the past it might have been a bit more difficult to find foreign films and then adapt them. But now it's all over the place. You can see them instantly, and so they're getting remade a lot quicker. It's frustrating, but that's what they do. I mean, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is a really good film, Fincher's film from last year, this year here. But is it worthy of a remake? Yeah. I tell you what, this film really surprised me. And I don't think it takes much to surprise Mark Wahlberg either. we'll get into a little bit why. And I like that your description avoided certain things. It kind of was very simple in the way that it goes about doing things for reasons that will probably become quite clear.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of like, it's not an original film. It's nothing new, but it's well executed, and it's daring where it ends up going with its tone. It starts out as this kind of classic, heist thriller film, even love story tied into there. It's very typical. It hits all the beats at the right moment. Like, it hits the music cues just right. We're introduced to his lover. We're introduced to his lover's, lover. We're introduced to his position, his job. It's all very methodical the way it comes out. But then the film takes an enormous turn, and we'll get into that a bit later. But what did you think of the film?
Yeah, look, I think this should be up there with such thrillers such as Hudson Hawk and Ocean's 12.
No,
I'm joking. It is well above those art heist thrillers. Yeah, look, I'm with you. This surprised me a lot. It was really enjoyable. I have one huge problem with the film that really will draw my rating down. And I'll mention it's the ending.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to say anything about the ending, it's the ending that really annoyed me. But it's the classic, as you said, you know, classic introduction of the characters. You see all about his life and how he goes about things. He's got a little secret and he's quite, you know, sort of snappy about it. Yeah. He has, you know, his methods of doing it. And it starts off as, you know, almost like a nice, you know, Ocean's 12 kind of setup. Yeah. Like, you know, they're committing crime, but they're, you know, a bit blasé about it. Then it goes sort of into almost a black comedy, and then it just goes into a balls to the wall thriller.
Yeah.
And it's the shifting between it where you're trying to keep up, but in a good way. Like you're like, hang on, what's happening here? This is just out of control. And look, it's fun. Like
it's really funny.
It's funny. It's just
gripping.
Yeah, and it's really well written as well, I thought. It's really quite snappy. Yeah. And I kind of freaked out when I saw Nicolas Costa-Valdu.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm like, this is Jaime Lannister from Game of Thrones.
Really?
Yeah, it is, yeah. And
look at you.
Yeah, and he speaks like utterly perfect English, as do most Scandinavians. So, yeah, I don't know why I brought that up. But anyway.
Interesting point.
Yeah, yeah, well made too. But it's a remake of a book, an adaptation of a book. I don't know, it's interesting. It's 98 minutes long, but it doesn't feel too short.
I don't know how it would work as a book, too.
Yeah, because...
it's very cinematic, and I mean, obviously, because it's a film, but like... but, you know, like, it has all the kind of classic action beats to it. It does juggle its tone quite efficiently and effectively. So I don't know how it would work as a book. Like, I don't know if you'd get the same suspense...
Yeah,
I mean, you could. Like, it's not like you can't. Nothing's impossible. But, you know, it just seems to me as it would work much better as a film.
Yeah, because a lot of the whole cat and mouse thing is very visually cued.
Yep.
That
could be in the translation. No, what's it called? Adaptation.
Yeah. So. Yeah. But I mean, I can see it just working better as a film. Like, those sort of, you know, peeking around the corner. You know, you got a dog come into play. And, you know, the sounds and you know... And slowly sinking into a pile of shit, which was just disgusting.
It was horrible.
Yeah, but yeah, look, overall, it was enjoyable. But as I said, it's the ending, and obviously we can't say too much about it.
Well, can we even talk about what happens? I think we can.
I think we can sort of talk about the setting up, maybe.
Yeah, it ends up being this guy's an art thief.
Yeah, which you know from like the first 5 seconds.
Like this is how he introduces himself. And it's really interesting how he introduces himself too. He introduces himself in a really kind of self-depreciating way, but also at the same time a very confident way. He's instantly a conflicted character, yeah?
Yeah.
Because he's like, he introduces himself as, hi, my name is Roger Brown and I'm 5'6", or whatever he says, 5'8", or however tall he is. 5'6". And so he's obviously compensating at the beginning. Then he talks about his $30 million roof for his house that he has and his incredibly attractive wife that he has. But he's insecure. To maintain this image, he's an art thief. And he also... what else does he do? Oh my God. He doesn't want to give his wife children. Like, he maintains control in every aspect of his life, overt control over everything. And then we find out later that he begins to lose control, and that methodical approach that he has to things starts to unravel when he finds out that his wife is perhaps not being as faithful as she should be, and that he's also being hunted, literally, by, as you said, a mercenary over a job interview. That's about as far as we can go. And
can you talk about why he possibly is being hunted?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a plot detail, but I don't think it's.
But it gets
spoiler.
Revealed a bit later.
Okay. No, but more so the what he discovers in the apartment of this.
Yeah.
Could you? I think we can mention.
All right,
that.
Go.
Well, it's basically like, you know, he's flogging things in art, and he has a guy on the side who takes it to Gothenburg in Sweden and sells it, and it's not enough to cover his expenses at all.
No.
It's kind of like he's
loves the allure of it.
I think so.
I think he loves being that double-faced, two-faced character.
Yeah, and he's very nonchalant about the fact that he's bordering bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And you know, just waves off his banker who calls him, and then he discovers that the guy, Klaus Greaves, who comes in and has just moved to Norway from the Netherlands. And he meets him at his wife's art show and basically discovers that his wife tells him that he has a Rubens painting, which could possibly be worth like hundreds of millions of dollars, which was lost during the Second World War. And that's where it all just starts to unravel.
Yeah. Okay. That you can say, definitely.
Yeah. That's
and that's kind of ties into the reason why he's being hunted by this guy.
Yeah.
And then, like the film, for the most part, yeah, you get introduced to this character, and he's got a total identity construction. Like he is completely insecure. He's constructed himself to project a particular image that he can't uphold, and he sees that one last job. You know, that great one last job.
Yeah.
He's like, I'll get out. This is the one that'll get me out now. And it all goes wrong, and obviously he begins to unravel within that and begin to see his true character and when it becomes a fight or flight situation. And there's a great sequence where he, in the process of this thing, he shaves his head. I won't say why. There's a great sequence where he reveals his shaved head to somebody in the film, and it's almost this bearing of his soul. Like it's this great transformation of this character that occurs.
Because he has quite long
blonde locks.
Yeah.
And they end up disappearing.
Mm.
But yeah, I really enjoyed that about it, and his character unraveling parallels really greatly with the film unraveling. Like it becomes this farcical, like absolutely, how far can we go putting this guy in a terrible situation? Like, and I think it might have some issues. Like some people may not pick up on that, but I found it pretty clear. Like there's a couple of pointers in there that really like hit you out, and there's like this one in particular was like those two obese policeman twins. Yeah, it's just a visual cue that lets you know that okay, we've deviated a bit from reality here. Yeah, and there's obviously the famous one, the big one with the dog.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's another one where like a policeman, his head is dismembered and it looks like a little raisin. And it's just a silly image. Like it just looks it looks so dumb. And it's just things like that that made the kind of made sure that the audience knew that they were in this new territory. And as I'm watching it, I'm like, no, please. Are you going to be able to sustain this? Are you going to be able to sustain this heightened like suspense thriller and this black dark comedy? And you know what? It did.
Yeah, I think it did. But it also, a couple of times, I was like, this is starting to get a bit ludicrous now.
Oh, but I loved it. Like it was like
but I was question marks starting to pop up.
Yeah,
for me a little.
Like as soon as I was locked into this ride, it could have gone anywhere for me. They could have got in a rocket and gone to space. Like it's that, you know, it's that kind of film, and I really would have enjoyed that.
Yeah,
but you know,
I think it's something about European directors. They can just do this with films, and it's like zany, but it just works.
But I think he knows. Like, it's very tongue-in-cheek. He knows that's the direction it's going. It's not like he's like, yeah, now we'll have a big action scene. And it's like...
Oh, it's that, a German, is it?
Yeah, that's it. They're all the same to me, man. I check the stats. We don't get any Europeans.
Okay, good.
No, but... you know, and like it's not just let's make another action scene. It's let's go nuts with this, and it really works.
I think the main character is also quite adapting to his situation as well.
Yeah,
like it's like he's living in the moment, but we know that deep down he's got no idea what's going on, but he's just doing whatever he has to do to survive.
Absolute survival. And that's what parallels in his actual life as well. Like, he's just doing what it takes to survive.
Yeah, and I think he's used to that. Yeah. He's just bringing it over to this. Yeah, look, I think, you know, the acting was pretty damn good.
Yeah.
Apparently his wife, it's her first role.
Really?
As well.
She's quite good too.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, so she doesn't play a very major role. She's kind of an integral part of the film, but not... presence isn't required.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like that the art thief thing kind of works like a Hitchcock MacGuffin.
A little.
At the start, it's like, oh, it's all about the art, getting that art. And then it's
irrelevant.
Who cares?
It becomes the cat and mouse.
Yeah, and it's great. I really enjoyed that. It kind of keeps you on your toes a little bit as well.
Yeah.
What didn't you like?
Go on. It's that ending.
But what about it? Can you say, like, without saying what it is, which part of the ending? Is it the wrap-up or is it the...
Yeah, it's the wrap-up.
The wrap-up, okay. It's, and what about the wrap-up?
Like, all I can really say is it's too little, you know, it's too much of it. It's all wrapped up in a neat little package.
Agreed.
It's too Hollywood for this film.
And I agree with you 100%. And then I got to thinking, is that similar to the way that the film is set up? Because I found the film set up to be quite tedious and quite cookie cutter as well.
Okay.
But then that worked when it actually went off the rails a little bit.
Look, it mirrors the bookend. You know, like the bookends are totally similar in its setup and its conclusion. But I've just felt that the end didn't justify the means from what we'd seen at the film. Like it seemed that, you know, that certain characters hadn't learnt anything.
That's my big problem.
And that was the big thing. Like they... It was just all like not anything that everything that preceded it didn't really happen.
Yeah,
and that was a huge problem for me.
I think there is a bit of it that is actually notifying how ridiculous the scenarios that preceded it were, and in that is wrapping it up in quite a silly way as well. Like it's all too perfect. Like it's just way too perfect.
Yeah,
and like a part of me can't believe that that's how they wanted it to end. A part of me knows that that's how they did. So I sit uneasy with that. Where I don't sit is a glorifying of the main character at the end. Like he is essentially a pitiful man. Like he's a pathetic human being. And like, you know, he needs psychological help, but the film does not go in that direction. And it's kind of like it makes us want to feel sorry for him. And I just couldn't feel sorry for him.
Look, I think there was a point I slightly felt almost where he's pouring himself out.
That's the bit where I was like, no.
Okay, because I was kind of like, you know, I was sensing a development or you know, a sense of character change, and he was trying. So I kind of got that. But
my whole thing was it's like love will save the day. Like, you know, love eradicates all previous wrongdoings.
Love conquers all.
Love conquers all, and it's just, no, he's... From the beginning, he was a twisted dude. Like,
and he was shallow. He's shallow. And, you know, he thought that throwing gifts at his wife would solve everything. And, you know, he kind of gets that, I guess. But, I mean, it was just a case of the characters not changing, but more that they didn't really determine what had happened throughout the film, and it hadn't really changed them in any way.
Fair enough. I don't like the ending very much either. I like everything that comes before it. It reminded me of Audition.
Oh, okay,
film. You know, the very first 45 minutes of that, a ridiculous, cheesy love story, and then the last brutal murder sequences.
Yeah.
A bit less obvious than
extreme,
that.
Extreme, yeah.
But, you know, similar operations going on.
That's pretty good comparison.
Anyway, did you have anything else?
No, that's it. It's pretty, not one-dimensional, but easy to follow, easy to watch.
I recommend it.
And yeah, me too. Look, it's enjoyable, and it's a good popcorn flick, but it still manages to have a sense of intelligence about it.
And a sense of humour. I'd like to see it with, like, a crowd, which I didn't do.
Yeah.
You can't win them all.
True.
What are you going to give it?
I'm going to give it a 7.5.
Mate, we are on ball today. Yeah, we are just right on par.
It would have been an 8 for me, but that ending...
7.5 for me as well, man. It really is the ending. And it's not that it's so bad. It's just that it doesn't justify what comes before it.
It doesn't respect everything that came before it.
And I'm still tossing up whether it does, whether it's intentional or not. But for the time being, let's hit it both at a 7.5. Headhunters is out now in a limited release. Quite limited, I think. Also out this week, we had John Carter. The big budget adaptation of the classic stories by Edgar Rice Burroughs, directed by Pixar regular Andrew Stanton, who did WALL-E and Finding Nemo. Two excellent films.
I don't like Finding Nemo.
You don't?
No.
Wow. Damn, sorry, man. What do you got against clownfish?
It's the clown
clowns.
Thing.
It's the clowns again.
No.
We're getting something here. We need you on a couch, man.
You've been reading too much Freud.
Tell me about it. Limited release, 50-50. Very limited, even more so than Headhunters.
Really?
Yeah, only
that's
at Cinema
quite
Nova.
Disappointing.
Here. Delayed release of comedy drama about a teen who finds out that he has cancer. Stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Seth Rogen.
Well, you got The Source
I've got
twice.
The Source twice. Yeah, I don't know why. But The Source is also out in limited release. A film set in the remote Arabic. I don't know. I couldn't find
any information. No, it is in the Middle East somewhere.
Okay. It's a village where women of the town withhold sex from the men if they don't bring them water from a well. That's the gist of it.
Metaphorical.
And your favourite film, Coriolanus, directed...
I'll be there. Front row centre.
Ray Fiennes' directorial debut in another modern-day Shakespeare adaptation centred on modern warfare. Modern Warfare 4, Coriolanus. Also stars Vanessa Redgrave. We're going to cut to a track. What track did you pick, my good friend?
I picked Harmony in My Head by the Buzzcocks, taken from their 1979 classic Singles Going Steady. Thought it matched the mood of the film a bit, and it's got the word head in it.
That's a good one.
The review you had on Shark Sandwich, which was merely a two-word review, just said shit sandwich.
Where'd they print that?
That's not real, is it?
When I say I'm in love, you best believe I'm in love, L-U-V.
And we're all just looking for a kiss, aren't we? Welcome back to the Last Picture Show podcast. Welcome to Demo Tapes, week three of Demo Tapes, our seven-week program dedicated to proto and classic punk, which we're going back and having a listen to some stuff. We've done a couple albums already, but this week we are coming to the end of our proto punk segment with New York Dolls, a direct injection into what will be the classic punk movement that follows with their self-titled album. But let's do it. New York Dolls were a rock band hailing from New York, of all places. Formed in 1971, the band are renowned for their incredibly camp and kitsch stage costumes in which they deck themselves out in women's apparel, heavy makeup, stack heels, $2 wigs, and performed live with an incredible veracity and no-holds-barred attitude. Much like the Stooges that preceded them, they pertain to a particular brand of anarchy whilst writing short, catchy, and abrasive pop songs with a street-smart, self-reflexive wit, paving the way for a number of scenes, such as, obviously, the classic UK punk, Sex Pistols in particular. Malcolm McLaren, the manager of Sex Pistols, worked with the Dolls at the end of their career, but also the post-punk New York rock scene and the heavy metal, glam metal stuff that came out. Their debut self-titled album is their most popular work, released in 1973 via Mercury Records and produced by Todd Rundgren. Yeah, and it's the topic of this week's Demo Tapes. So let's just do this. What do you think of New York Dolls? You've listened to it before.
I have,
a few
yeah.
times. This is a new one for me once again. What do you think?
Yeah, look, I think it's great. Like, this is, for me, this is probably the most I've seen out of the three that we've had is... the amount of influences that the amount of bands that they have influenced is just crazy. You can just tell by the sound, like for instance the song Trash.
Yep.
You can just tell that's where the Pixies, the Strokes, like early Strokes.
Yeah, I didn't pick up on that.
Yeah, got their sound from. Yeah. This was the whole sort of glam rock movement right here. Not as good, obviously.
Come on, man, Kiss. Nice and Satan's Service.
Tears are falling.
I don't hate some Kiss, but anyway.
Yeah, but, you know, Twisted Sister, obviously, yeah. Motley Crue. This is where they
Poison.
This is where they all got their...
Look.
Their look and sound from. Yeah. And unfairly, these guys kind of get a bit buried.
Yeah.
You know, sort of in between, somewhere between, you know, MC5 and, like, sort of pre-Rolling Stones sort of era. They're sort of just lumped in there and they sort of slip away. Which is unfortunate because this album's fantastic. Like it's just really, really great sort of glam with edge, kind of like what Bowie was trying to do, I guess, in a way. But these guys are obviously much more underground influence.
Stones as well.
Yeah, I think so.
Big Stones influence.
Yeah.
Like, coming from this sort of crazy, abrasive and camp attitude as well. Jagger and his scarves and his lips and his strut. Like, you know, it was all kind of there. Like, you can see the lineage as well, which got me thinking, like, of the Stones influencing punk as well. And, of course, they would be.
I think they definitely did,
but
yeah.
not maybe not as direct as this.
No, and probably more the attitude side.
That's what I got mostly from this, is the attitude that you can see that direct lineage from.
Yeah, but you can definitely see this being like, I don't know how we plan this, but this is obviously a great gateway into the Ramones.
Oh.
Like, it's mental.
Yeah, I know.
And you know, I think
it's going to be like, we'll just cut and paste this and just change every instance of New York Dolls to the Ramones.
Yeah, but it really, you can tell, like, this you know, paved the way for that whole New York punk scene, really. Yeah. But yeah, you know, that's my initial thoughts on it.
Yeah, me too. I really liked it. I think I liked it least out of the three that we've listened to thus far, for numerous reasons, but, like, it's still great. It is a lot of fun to listen to, and it is fun to pick out exactly where you can see the links being made in the chain. And, yeah, the Ramones, like, it's all that attitude that you already mentioned. It's the New York slur, you know. It's the street-smart, wise-cracking lyrics and delivery. And, of course, it's the dressing up. Like, and it's the first instance, really, of it happening on such a grand scale. Like, Jagger, yeah, he kind of dons some makeup every now and then. But, like, this is the whole band getting in full gear, full get-up, full sort of, you know, effeminate gear, but not... But as a form of uber sort of hyper masculinity within that, yeah? So it's,
and
like...
Androgyny.
It's also, like, look how, you know... It could be both ways, yeah. And I struggle to kind of contemplate which way it goes. I mean, it could be a bisexual thing, androgynous thing. Like, it could be working that way, but it also could work in an ultra-masculine way. It could work in a way that, look at how comfortable we are with our masculinity. We'll dress up as women just to prove it and get up on stage and dance around like women. Like, and it could really go either way, but on the surface level... It is a statement, and it is just a sort of anti-establishment. This is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. Like, there's really no reason for it. We're just doing it because it's not what you do. And we're going to embrace that and enjoy that. And it's really interesting. Like, and yeah, you mentioned all the, you know, this kind of thing would be carried off. Like, Kiss just stole it.
Oh, and completely,
and the glam rocks, the glam metal guys, they all just took it and went with it. But you'll also get it with the Sex Pistols. You'll get it with, like, the UK. They code themselves as well, the punk rockers, with their leather and their pins, you know, and their haircut, whatnot. You know, Sex Pistols guitarist Steve Jones said that he felt shame because he found himself mimicking Johnny Thunder's style so much. And, like, you can just see everybody looking at this. I watched a video, and I think I put it on our Facebook, of them performing live in 73. And they had these little quotes at the bottom, and it was like Morrissey said that this was the most emotional experience he remembers having watching on television, watching them play live.
Well, they more or less, you know, formed the Smiths because he was... I think he's actually the president of the New York Dolls fan club.
Yeah, he was, yeah. I don't know if he still is.
Probably not. But, like, he loved them.
Yeah, I know. And so, yeah, it was an incredibly moving experience for him. And it's like you can see a whole bunch of people just tuning right into this, just tuning into this sort of, this is weird and different, but it speaks to me and I like it. So, I enjoyed this album. I got some other things, but what else have you got? What else have you got?
Well, I mean, you also can see them sort of setting up this whole New York scene. Like, you know, you got bands like Talking Heads, Television, you know, sort of this whole movement, I guess, in terms of people just being comfortable playing whatever they want. I mean, like, the music scene at this time was saturated with sort of prog, like, really, you know, very, very sort of, I guess, like, look, there was some great prog during this time, but there was also, you know, bands like Yes and
Genesis.
Hey, look, I don't mind some early Genesis. But, I mean, like, you know, bands that were, yeah, like, you know, just saturated with this sort of thing. And this band just, you know, totally went against that. And that's just the punk ethos, you know, going against what's the norm and doing what they enjoy. And you can tell they're enjoying themselves. And you know, they really don't care about what people think of their music. And, you know, a lot of it's just kitsch and taking the piss. And they know that. It's firmly tongue-in-cheek. And it's great. I mean, but the main draw of this is just spotting. They change it up quite often, I felt. Like, they also try a bit of ballad stuff, which is
Lonely Planet Boy.
Yeah, which is sort
which
of...
Which is really Stones.
Yeah, big time. Like, and you know, that's kind of rare in punk.
It does, towards the end of the album, I feel, get a little bit samey. But, you know, I guess that is, like, the punk thing. It's like, you know, we're going to play the same thing and we're going to shove it down your throat. It's going to be quick, it's going to be fast, and it's going to be like an enema in your brain. But I don't know if they're really trying to achieve that at this point. Like, the one thing I found interesting is that the use of their pop stylings and structures, which punk kind of does do. Like, punk, essentially, they are pop songs. Like, they're short and fast. Yeah. And they're meant to instill a great amount of emotional stirring instantly within you. And that's what pop was doing. Like, it was supposed to be 2-3 minutes. It's like, what's his name? The guy who went crazy and killed him, his wife, and, oh, my goodness, with a shotgun, and produced the White Album. No, Let It Be. Phil Spector, was he was doing with the pop orchestra stuff. It's like, you know, let's condense an orchestra down to 4 minutes and have it just this huge, swirling, emotional connection and catharsis. This is what, it's the same thing. And the New York Dolls apparently had a fascination with girl groups of the 50s as well.
Yeah, and you can tell that this is just like a pastiche of those.
Yeah, but it's like, what they do is they take the structure of the and the ideas of the song and they inject it with anarchy and fear and attitude. They take the formula and use it to promote this new sort of underground cultural identity in an accessible and digestible form. So it's like they take the pop, but they make it messed up and take what they know about the street and about how things operate in New York City and are able to sell it to a whole bunch of people. And that's kind of how punk works as well, I think. Like, you know, I'm not a punk expert, but it seems to me it's like quick, sharp, energetic burst of attitude and anarchy, and that's how you get it. And it's easy to take, and you just want more. And I liked that about this, is that that's kind of, they use the structure to promote the culture, and it's, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely on here. But then again, you know, you get a song like Frankenstein, which is like 6 minutes long.
Yeah, that's an anomaly, I think.
Yeah, no, within that. Yeah, like they do it a few times, you know, on this album. But that's why I kind of like that they're trying to throw in their own stuff besides the punk. But the songs.
Well, it's all their own stuff at this point, you know, like.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really a punk sort of you know, genre or movement really as such. I mean, it's starting to form, but no one really knows what it is yet. And I think that's why...
No reviewer has defined it yet.
No, exactly. So, you know, like, I mean, Frankenstein's great. It's got a real sort of Cramps and B-52s feel to it as well. Like, I mean, it's like they know a lot about music and the fact that they know what they like, but they're also putting their own edge on it, as you said.
Yep, definitely.
And that's what's good about them is that they're prepared to take, you know, the pop sensibilities of 50s and 60s bands and just totally bastardize into something that works for them and works for their scene.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a sign of a good band. I mean, I know a lot of, like, their later stuff is just awful. Mm. Even their next
album. They reunited as well, didn't they?
They did.
Yeah, and come on, man.
Yeah, didn't
glory days.
exactly. But like this album, they just do it perfectly. Yeah. And it wouldn't get any better for them. But you know, this is the sign of things to come, and this is the big bridge from, you know, the defining moments to the moment.
Yeah.
And this is when it starts to just take off, like in New York and, of course, the UK, where it explodes. And that's, you know, to do with the Sex Pistols and you know, them hearing it and, you know, and then people hearing them. And that's how punk spread, word of mouth. And I think that's why it kind of maintains that anarchy, that chaoticness to it, because it's all people hearing from first-hand experience rather than CDs. It's more it's more gigs and that sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely. And like their live shows and stuff were pretty crazy as well, from what I hear. Like getting spat on was like generally a hello, almost like a greeting. Yeah. And they were heavy drug users as well.
They were.
And that, like, it's I'm sure it's something we'll talk about a lot later, but that kind of feeds into the whole something that's really quite instrumental to the punk movement and the youth punk movement, and that is the drug use tying in with the sort of suburban alienation and this and the weird boredom that the youth of this period are feeling. And this is how it comes out. It comes out in distractions of drugs and alcohol, but it also comes out through this nihilistic and crazy music that they're making that they can identify with. And so it's like an escapism on many levels for them. And New York Dolls kind of starting with that. They're all drug users. You know, they're messed up on stage a lot. They write, like, the song Pills kind of starts to hint at this idea. Like, not particularly. Like, it's still kind of a rock and roll song, but it's a rock and roll song about drugs. And in a very explicit way, much like Velvet Underground would do, you know, like that sort of thing. And so, yeah, it's kind of starting to get that way, and I'm pretty sure we'll get it a lot later, especially with some of the UK stuff, like UK social situation is very much instrumental in how the punk movement goes on there. But, yeah, I like that I kind of got a little hint of it here as well.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, I mean, punk, personally, like, you don't really hear much about drugs. It's more huge drinking.
Yeah, but it like alcohol is still a drug, you know, like it's still in a form, like, and a lot of like pubs in Britain, like these blue collar workers just go and get smashed at pubs.
Yeah, you know? And then that's, as you mentioned, to do with the social aspect and the social scene at the time. Yeah. It was, you know, escapism, as you said. And you know, it's kind of weird. Like, I mean, New York wasn't necessarily, I think, going through a bad...
I think it was in the 70s.
Really?
Yeah, in your 70s is not a particularly light period.
Would it be racial?
No, it's. I think it was, at that point, it was very dirty. It was, there was a lot of crime. You watch a film like Taxi Driver.
Okay, yeah.
That's the kind of idea that I think New York was, from what I know, New York was not in a great state then and kind of came out of it in like the late 80s and stuff. So, I don't know. But yeah, like it's not so much here, but later I'm sure it's going to get much more interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
On like a personal note, yeah, I like the album. I didn't love it. Like I enjoy most of it. It gets a bit long in the tooth for me towards the end. And to be honest with you, like, I would probably, if a gun was put to my head, I would probably opt to go and listen for their contemporaries. Like, I would probably listen to Bowie, and I'd probably listen to the Rolling Stones instead of them. You know
Definitely,
what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, they're still representative of the culture they come out of, but at the same time, they experiment a bit more, and they, you know, mix things up a bit. But it's like, you know, a single entity, this is quite a good album, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's totally spot on. I mean, it's often the case that the, you know, I mean, look at Kraftwerk.
Yeah,
I mean, how many people they influenced, but I don't really like them at all.
Autobahn from the Big Lebowski are influenced
with their classic Nagelbert. but But yeah, like it's a case of people taking what they did and, you know, and improving on that.
Yeah.
And I guess that's kind of what the art form is in a way. It doesn't necessarily always work out, but in this case, I think it has. But you know, for what they've done, you just can't deny. I mean, look, I really enjoyed it, but yeah,
it's got its flaws. Yeah,
As there's most punk music.
Probably, which we may find out next week. Maybe. I don't know.
Maybe. Well,
I'm very excited to go back and listen to it again because it's been like 5 years since I listened to the Ramones self-titled.
You hated it.
And I despised it.
Yeah.
But my musical inclinations have changed a bit since then, so we'll see how we go.
We'll see how we go. But
it'll
be
an interesting week.
I mean, I've more or less exhausted my wealth of information on this album.
Yeah, me too. No, it's a good album, and I suggest you have a look if you're interested in the roots punk, much like anything we've spoken about thus far.
Yeah.
It's out in places you can get it. Don't know where. We didn't have it at our store
that we work at,
but, you know, Ash Ketchum, you better get onto that, mate, if you're listening. But, yeah, that's about it. We hope you enjoyed the show this week, our final episode of Proto-Punk Exploration. Next week, we're going to be headed into the classic punk realm, pre-1978 kind of stuff. We're going to start it off with another New York band, The Ramones, and their self-titled album from 1976. What else are we going to be looking at?
We're going to be looking at... I'm really not excited about this.
I am.
It's the film 21 Jump Street.
Woo! Channing Tatum!
Yeah, look, I saw the trailer and I'm like, this looks appalling.
It's me too.
But you're...
You got to give the comedies a go.
Yeah, but...
And I've heard good things.
Yeah, you have.
So, let's do it.
Yeah.
21 Jump Street.
And we're also, the possible two albums we're going to look at, the first one.
Odd Future's new collaborative album, the OF tape volume 2, but possibly if that doesn't manifest, it'll be
The Shins, Port of Morrow.
But I'll let you know on the old Twitter and the Facebook before that.
Yeah.
Of course, if you like the show, if you dislike the show, if you think the show is rubbish, if you think the show is great, you can head over to lastpictureshowpodcast.com, leave us a comment, have a look, or you can send us an email, lastpictureshowpodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, well, look, there was a couple of comments on there, actually. Maybe we should read a couple next week.
We'll see how we go.
Yeah. I think we should, to encourage people to comment.
I know.
Yeah.
Get on it, people.
Yeah, and also our Twitter page, which is /TLPS podcast. It's very active.
And what's yours? Get them onto you as well.
Yeah, look, I've finally, you know, sort of reinvented my Twitter page. It's /TheCountDuke.
I added you.
You did. And I've tracked down a few people on there, most against their will. And
that's how it works.
But yeah, add us. I'm very active on there, so shoot us a line regarding the show or anything, really.
You can head to our iTunes page as well.
Yeah, give us a review.
Yeah,
either positive or negative, just constructive.
And we'll let you know where the album's going to go next week. But until then, we hope you enjoy the show. My name is Simon DiBerardino,
and I am Adam Robertson.
You all have a good week now.
Nugget.